You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 65 of Take a Bow. I'm your host, Eli Tokash, and oh my goodness, do we have so much to talk about this week. As you know, last week, maybe some of you don't, I wasn't able to talk about all the Broadway news that has happened last week because I was sharing stories about my Broadway news. And so this week, I'm just going to catch up on all of that to make sure everyone is kind of aware what's going on. And so there's a lot to talk about because it's kind of like 2 weeks worth, but I'll keep it short, I promise. We'll get right into it, and then we'll turn it over to the Drama Dictionary, and then we'll turn it over to our wonderful guest, Jay Armstrong Johnson. So stay tuned for that. Before we get to it, let's talk about what's going on. So I don't know if everyone has heard the all of my previous episodes, but I did kind of make an educated guess, I guess you could say, that West Side Story will not be returning to Broadway. I just thought it was a little fishy with everything going on, the politics between the shows when it was on Broadway just wasn't good. And then, of course, when everyone was announced they were opening, and then they kind of were like a show in the dust that like kind of wasn't saying anything, I kind of figured that they weren't going to open. And it had just come out just last week, or maybe this week even, that it will, in fact, not be returning. So it's sad because I kind of enjoyed this version of West Side Story. I did think it was something new. I think it was something modern, and I think it was something relatable. But I just think with like everything going on right now, and of course the West Side Story movie coming out, I just think it's just too much. And I believe the producers felt the same, and that there was no reason to reopen it and to continue paying all that money to produce the show. It just didn't make sense. So West Side Story will not be returning, and it's one of the few Broadway shows that has kind of said that they won't be returning while everyone else has been making announcements, because the shows that really were closing kind of announced it during the whole pandemic, during the prime of the pandemic, I guess you could say. There has been some controversy going around the Broadway world recently surrounding Broadway star Laura Osnes, who, I mean, was in Bandstand. She was a Disney princess in Cinderella. She's been in a bunch of Broadway shows, and she was accused of being fired from a show because she was refusing to get the COVID-19 vaccine. And apparently, that's not the case. She came out and said that wasn't the case. I was never fired. However, I did quit because I'm still uncertain about the vaccine. And I just think that this was very interesting. I mean, she's in a show with my dear friend Tony Yazbek, who was in Finding Neverland with me, and he was in On the Town with our guests today. And he has a family, you know, like he has a family, and you know, like all of these actors do, they go home and they go to their job, and then they go home to their families, you know, and it's just, there's too much of a risk to not get vaccinated and not be vaccinated. And now Equity is requiring these vaccinations for everybody for the safety of the cast and the cast's family, as well as everyone else involved as far as the audience and things like that. However, she still was like, no, I'm not doing it. And I guess she had stepped down. She was going to do a show out in the Hamptons with Tony Yazbek, but refuses to take the shot. And like I said, I found this very interesting because, you know, as a theater actor, we've been out of work for 2 years now. And it's like this vaccine requirement isn't going to go anywhere, I believe. I believe it's going to be around for another 2 years, you know, like that everyone's required, and eventually it's going to be required for everyone. And it's not even going to be like, oh, let me see your vaccine. It's just going to be like one of those shots that we like have to get, like when we go to our doctors, you know. I don't know. That's me. But I just think it's very interesting because she's already been out of work for 2 years. And as a theater actor, it's like, how are you not going to work for another 1 to 2 years? Like that's going to be 3, 4, 5 years without work. And she's also not going to be able to see a Broadway show. She's not even going to be able to see live theater anymore. She can't, like, go to a restaurant if she lives in New York. Like, there's just all these things that's, like, kind of mind-blowing to me that she's just still sticking to her guns. But I don't know. I have mixed feelings on this, but I thought I had to let everyone know because this is just such a big deal. I mean, with her being who she is, kind of refusing and kind of taking a stand and kind of, you know, like I said, refusing to take the vaccine is kind of like a big deal, especially with how things are now, you know, like, and everything is just, it seems like more and more lately, especially with this new Delta variant, that things are just more and more things are requiring the vaccine. So like our daily lives almost require the vaccine, especially here in New York. Not everywhere, of course, but here in New York is extra careful, I guess you could say. And so, yeah, I just thought it was very interesting. And Laura Osnes, I mean, we'll look out for it, but hopefully she does change her mind because, you know, like, I don't know, like, you just can't go out of work with that long. And I personally believe that, like, if you are someone who truly loves theater and you're a theater person and you work in the arts and whatnot, like, you just can't go that long without seeing a Broadway show. And like, all your friends are going to support your other friends. And like, you're kind of like the odd man out. I don't know. It just seems very, surprising to me. And especially as someone who kind of was a fan of Laura Osnes, and I still am a fan of her work, but like it was surprising. So we'll move on because there's lots to think on that one, and it's still kind of registering with me. But I thought I would report it. So there's two sides of the story. One was saying that she's fired, and then she had talks with some other news sources and kind of came out and said, well, no, I actually quit because I'm still learning and taking some time to get to make sure I know the unknowns with the vaccine. And she was like, I still want time. And if I choose, like, it's my body, I can choose what I want to do with it. And that's totally respectable. So very interesting stuff happening. I'm sure that that will not be the only case in reporting of that. But yes, that's the story with Laura Osnes, and that was kind of some buzz going on around the Broadway world today and lately. Ben Platt, you all know my love for Ben Platt, okay? I love Ben Platt. I love his music so much. Sing to Me Instead was his debut album, was literally like, it still like plays on repeat some days. I just get in those moods. But he has a new album out called Reverie, and it's brilliant. There's these songs that are so relatable, especially like, okay, so it's interesting because they are total, like he's totally going a pop route with his new, with this album, but these songs are so relatable as a theater kid. So it's very, there's like a dynamic of both that that entices me almost to just continue to listen and continue to find new things every time I listen, because, you know, it's this pop style, and maybe that's not like everybody's favorite, especially in the theater world. You know, like, we're used to like, it are the roots of being golden age and everything, and now pop is kind of going like off the rails in a way. But this way, he does a beautiful job, like just kind of incorporating both in so many ways, but also staying true to himself and his theater background and who he is as a person. You know, he has these songs called like Childhood Bedroom, Happy to Be Sad, I Want to Love You But I Don't, Dance with You, Dark Times. Like, all of these songs are so relatable as someone who is a theater kid, like, in a way, all theater kids have to mature really quickly. And that was kind of something that he alluded to in finding who he was really quickly and trying to navigate all of these emotions without, I don't know, it's hard to explain because he couldn't really like be expressive of himself because of, you know, he was still trying to figure out all these things, and it was very new to him, and he had to do it so young that he didn't even know what it was, you know, like, he just thought it was like, he just knew it wasn't like what everyone else around him was doing. And he talks a lot about it in his concerts and everything. And you can really see that through his storytellings of this album. So I really enjoy it. It's wonderful. That's one of the beautiful things about like artists. You really get to know someone through their songs. And I think just between his last album and this album, but of how vastly different they are, but at the same time, they're still connected and they're still portraying similar stories, and you really get to know who Ben Platt is. And I just think it's beautiful, you know. I don't know. I could geek about Ben Platt all day long. It's wonderful. If you haven't listened to it yet, go listen to it. Just search up Reverie or Ben Platt and something will come out. And now he's going on tour and he's going to be at Madison Square Garden and all of these crazy places. He's just going to be doing another tour of this album. And I just can't wait. I am so excited for all of it. I did a new topic. I did see Aretha Franklin, the musical. Oh my God, it wasn't a musical. It was the story of Aretha Franklin. It was like a docu-movie with my friends Nikki Torsha, who created the songs and like the beats and stuff that you hear on these episodes, and my dear friend Alexa Nijak. We went to go see it, and it had all of these Broadway stars in it. It had Audra McDonald, it had Jennifer Hudson, it had Titus Burgess, it had the young Aretha was one of the young Nalas and Lion King. All of these wonderful people were in it, and all of these wonderful theater actors were in it, and in a way you could see it, you know. And it wasn't because their acting was over the top or whatever these people say with theater actors and film when they do film and stuff, but it was just their light. You could tell their joy of performing and their vocal gifts. You could just tell that they were a part of the theater and they were doing stuff on theater, even if you didn't recognize them right away. Because some of them was like, oh, you know, like I know who that is, but I can't really put my finger on it. And then you're like, oh my God, that's brilliant. What amazing casting. Forest Whitaker was in it. All of these just incredible, incredible actors. This cast is star-studded. Aretha Franklin's story is just absolutely mind-blowing. I did not know as much that I've learned during the musical that I do now, or the movie, excuse me. I keep saying musical because it just she sang so many songs, Jennifer Hudson, just because it was kind of like, It was like Rocket Man for Elton John. It was kind of like Bohemian Rhapsody and like all of these movies that has come out recently. And it was just her life and following her almost, and it just paid tribute to her. And I just loved every second of it. It was quite long. It was 2.5 hours, so it did feel like a musical, which is quite long for a movie. But I have to say, there wasn't one time that I got bored or was like checking my phone to see what time it was or doing whatever. Like, They held you in it. That it was just, there was so much to talk about that it was that long, and you were fully invested for the full 2.5 hours. It was awesome, and it was my first time in a movie theater after the 2 years and during all this COVID stuff. So it was very great. Like I said, you know, I can't get enough of this. The music in my life again, and kind of art to get to watch. And there's just so much to catch up on, and I'm so excited to be doing all of it. I've just been trying to go through all of these like places and watch new things. And of course, you know, I see a musical movie and I'm like, that's the first movie I'm going to see, you know, like, I don't know. That's just how it is lately. And you know, once I got a taste of it, I haven't been able to stop. So with that being said, let's talk about some real Broadway news. As last week, casts really began to roll out for a lot of these musicals. And I'm going to share with you mainly the main casts, because the ensemble, I just don't have time to say everyone. Otherwise, this podcast is going to be super long. So I'm just going to highlight some of the actors going to be in these new musicals. And I'll specify which musicals I talk about first. So first, I'm going to talk about MJ, the Michael Jackson musical, which previews begin December 6th and opening night is February 1st, which is quite a long time for previews. It's about 2 months. Wow. So Miles Frost has been announced to play Michael Jackson, but his supporting cast and the other wonderful, talented people in this cast has been casted around him as well. So Antoine L. Smith is playing Barry Gordy / Nick. Quentin Earl Darrington as Joseph Jackson / Rob. Whitney Basher as Rachel. Gabriel Ruse as Alejandro. Joey Sorge as Dave. John Edwards as Jackie Jackson. Ayanna George as Catherine Jackson. Apollo Levine as Quincy Jones / Tito Jackson. Tavon Olds Sample as Michael. Lamont Walker II as Jermaine Jackson. And Zelig Williams as Marlon Jackson. Wow. Okay, this cast is incredible. When I am naming these casts and I'm saying all of their names, I do apologize if I pronounce anybody's names wrong. And if I kind of stumble through, names aren't really my thing. But I do want to announce it because I just think especially with this show, a lot of them are having Broadway debuts. It's kind of like their breakouts as far as like, you know, it's their first time leading a show and whatnot. So there's just a lot of very exciting things surrounding this cast. And I think that it's going to be brilliant. And I hope to have a lot of these performers on because they're all, this is kind of like an interesting show that I really want to talk about with Michael Jackson, because just his story and everything surrounding him with the Neverland documentary and everything. I do want to talk about how they're going to do this musical and kind of pay tribute to him, but like more so his art, and maybe not so much him as a person. I don't know. I just wonder how it's going to all go down. Casts have been coming out recently surrounding, you know, Broadway obviously is coming back. So casts are rolling out recently with Hadestown, Aladdin, Lion King, Michael Jackson, and of course, Waitress. So all these casts have been coming out the past like week and a half. And I kind of wanted to share them with you because there's a lot of familiar faces returning to shows, which is very exciting. Michael James Scott is going to be returning to Aladdin as the genie. Don Darrell Rivera is going to be Iago again in Aladdin. Jonathan Freeman will be reprising his role as Jafar. J.C. Montgomery as Sultan. There's a lot of familiar faces in Aladdin, which is very exciting. Same with Hadestown, Reef Carney, Eva Noblezada, Andre DeShields, Amber Gray. Are going to be returning to Hadestown, as well as Patrick Page, but not until November 2nd. And for the month that Patrick Page is going to be missing, from September 2nd when they open to November 1st, Tom Hewitt, a friend of mine who is in Finding Neverland, will be stepping into his place as Hades for that month, which is very exciting. And a little bit of their cast is going to be changed because some of them are going on tour with the show in some leading roles. So that's very exciting for them. And let's see, Tina Turner, Daniel J. Watts, Adrian Warren, Don Lewis, they are all returning. A lot of the company is still the same. Jessica Rush, who also has a podcast on the Broadway Podcast Network, is going to be returning. Let's talk about Waitress. Oh, my goodness. I think I already talked about this. I already talked about Waitress in last week's episode. So never mind. We don't have to talk about Waitress. But I do want to talk about Waitress at the same time, because I was thinking the other day, Waitress has the best opening number for Broadway's return. Like, I wish that everyone, like, they could live stream and everyone can witness just that number for the first time back, you know, because it's literally called opening up. So like, what is better than that? You'll get right into the mood of things when you hear that song. And I just think that is going to be the longest applause and the longest wait in between a number that Broadway is going to be having to do when all these shows return. I think that'll be the longest hold. And just because they're talking about opening up, letting the day in, and then we'll say hello, how you been? And it's like looking around and it's like, oh my God, it's like magical, right? And I don't know. I just hope I get to be there for one of those important shows where it's like, you know, you have such a long hold. You got so many of the original cast back. You got Sarah Bareilles back in it. All of these things. So, yeah, that's my tangent of just the Broadway shows opening back up. A little taste of Broadway again. I think it's just going to be magical. I'm so excited for all of it. There's one show right now, and I have to say I'm already feeling the Broadway is back, but there's so much more to come back, and I'm so excited. Like, I still feel like it's so far away, but also it's like kind of like right here. It's really like 2 weeks away if we really think about it, which is just so exciting. And I just get more and more excited every day. So that's my little tangent about casts coming back and Broadway reopening. Enough about that. Let's turn it over to the Drama Dictionary. And this week's Drama Dictionary Word of the Week is going to be something that was sent in from a listener. Thanks, Pat McNamara. So if you ever have any questions as far as you may not know what something means, please feel free to reach out and I will explain it on an episode of the podcast. This week we had a listener reach out and ask, can you clarify kind of what a 29-hour reading is? And a 29-hour reading is something that we talk a lot about on the podcast. So I do apologize for not making it clear enough. However, it's kind of exactly what it sounds like. A 29-hour reading is a 29-hour reading, and that you have 29 hours of work, basically, to figure out your show in a lot of ways. It's basically, you know, the writers, the directors, the producers, everyone, all the creative team comes in with their piece that they've been working on for the past 7 years. And usually it's like one of the first times that they actually put pieces and voices and faces and everything all together. And they really get to hear it aloud for one of the first times by professional actors. And then as this happens, it's like, oh, well, now hearing this aloud and hearing how actors are taking this line or this song or this moment and whatever it may be, it's like, oh, that needs to be, there's something more there, or that needs to be written. Rewritten, not written, because it was already written. But that needs to be rewritten. That needs to be fixed. That needs to do this. And then it's just kind of perfecting their piece before they make it to a Broadway stage. Because as you know, these previews usually only last for about 3 weeks. Because as you know, these previews do not last very long. They are only about 3 weeks to a month is kind of the average or kind of the expectation, I guess you could say. And those are mostly focused on technique and spacing and blocking issues and lighting and set pieces. It's not so much about the work. So the work needs to be put in place and pretty solid before you even enter the theater. And so that is kind of the goal of the 29-hour reading, just to make sure that, you know, as they continue to rewrite and as they continue to make changes, just to make sure they put it in front of whoever it may be, especially with the cast of kids. It's like, oh, I'm an adult writing this for kids and I want to see how this is going to be taken, from a kid's perspective and as a kid portraying it. It's a way of them to really, really see what they have on their paper as they have been writing this for the past however many years and however many hours it's been taking them. And it's just a safe space. It's highly confidential of the projects until, of course, after it opens and after it makes it, or if it does make it. The Greatest Showman readings were all 29 hours, and we talk a lot about that and just how, oh, these songs weren't in it, and oh, these lines were different, and oh, this person had a bigger role and then something happened and it just couldn't make it work and it didn't make sense or whatever. And it's exactly that. It's just it allows the writers and the producers and the director, it allows everyone in the creative team to really get to know their work and how it's being taken from people who are going to be portraying it, because then that's how it's going to be taken from the audience members and the people that go support this piece of art and that they have created. So it like I said, it's just a safe space to kind of figure out what you've got. And it's called 29 hours because you only have 29 hours of work, and they're allowed to, so it doesn't limit them to like, 2 days or 3 days. You can do a 29 hour reading over the course of a month. You could do it over a course of the week. You could do it over a course of like 5 days, like Monday through Friday or Monday through Thursday, because then you want to rest up for your, or it's like Monday through Friday and then you have Wednesday off because it's a two show day, and like all of these things. So there's just a lot of things that go into it, but you are agreeing as a actor and as a producer and whatever that you are will be in a room for 29 hours, and that's kind of the limit that Equity gives you. So yeah, that's this week's Drama Dictionary Word of the Week. I hope that helps. I could elaborate on it more. I could go on tangents forever, but that's not what I'm going to do, because we're already far enough into the episode where I think we're all wanting to hear from our fabulous guest, J.A. Johnson, or J. Armstrong Johnson, of course, who has so many exciting things coming out, and we talked about all of it. So I'm very excited for you all to listen to this week's episode. We also talk about some of his favorite roles, such as On the Town. We also talk about Phantom of the Opera. We also talk about I Put a Spell on You and his 54 Below concert coming up, and of course his Broadway debut, and so many more exciting things. So this episode is really great. I think you all love it. J. Armstrong Johnson says so many valuable things and so many life lessons. So I can't thank Jay enough for coming on the podcast. And let's turn it over to him, shall we? J. Armstrong Johnson, curtain up.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Okay, today you folks get to hear from a Broadway veteran of 6 Broadway shows and a multi-award nominated actor, most known for his performances most recently in On the Town and Phantom of the Opera. Coming up, you can celebrate his birthday with him at 54 Below on September 1st. So everyone, welcome to Take a Bow, J. Armstrong Johnson.
Hey, Eli.
Hey. Oh my goodness, I'm so excited for you to be here. There's so many exciting things to talk about, not just your upcoming 54 Below show, but your entire resume. Come on, 6 Broadway shows, as you should. The way I usually like to start these off is kind of asking my guests why we're here. Like, what got us into theater, and like, what was that just trigger moment for you that was like, that's what I want to do in my life?
Yeah, I mean, I remember thinking early on that I wanted to be a performer. Singing in church was kind of the first time I really started singing in front of like what you would call an audience or a congregation. So that was kind of like my foray into performing, even though it was a religious setting. And I remember being super excited about the like fifth grade play that Mr. Ingram's English class would put on, they'd put on a very abridged production of Romeo and Juliet every year. And so I remember as a third and fourth grader being really excited about getting into the fifth grade so I could possibly play Romeo and Romeo mm-hmm. and Juliet. And then my sister played Juliet the year before me.
Yes.
And so I was like, okay, I've got to get Romeo. So I like wrote Mr. Ingram like a letter and I was like, please consider me for the role of Romeo. Like, and what fourth grade, what like fifth grade boy in Texas and like the, right. the late 90s was like begging to wear white tights and recite Shakespeare in their cafetoria? You know what
oh
I mean?
Oh my God. That's
so
incredible.
But I think what solidified it for me was when I did my first like, production, like with like a community theater. I did this community theater program called Kids Who Care Musical Theater. My friends at church who I sang in the choir with invited me to this theater to audition. Cause they were like, hey, you can sing, like you'll probably like this show, this the theater company. So I auditioned for A Midsummer Night's Dream, the rock musical.
Yes.
And I remember I got cast as one of the three Pucks, me and two other actors. We were like, I don't know, 8, 10, and 12 or something like that. We were like a three-headed Puck.
Oh, my God.
And I remember walking on the stage for the first day of tech rehearsals and feeling completely transformed. Like the lights yes. that were created by my friend Chad Jung, the set that was created by Bob LaValle. I mean, like I was in a different world.
Right.
And I just remember thinking, like, I have to chase this feeling for the rest of my life.
Yeah. I mean, is there a lot, like you said, you're from Texas. Is there a lot of theater involved? Like, is that something that's like kind of big out there?
Yeah. I always thought that I kind of grew up in like a small town.
Right.
I've come to realize that like Fort Worth is actually like the 10th or 11th largest city in the country.
Oh,
but I kind of grew up between like cow pastures and like downtown big city. So
right.
it feels like a small town in certain regards, but yeah, theater is huge. And from yeah. where I'm from, Dallas, Fort Worth in general has so much culture, so much yeah. theater. I mean, I think rodeos are pretty theatrical in like,
right.
and how they present to the world, you know? So theater has always been kind of there.
Totally.
There's always been this contingency of like weirdo, progressive artists in that world, that kind of help battle those other conservative coalitions.
Yes. Right. Right. That's okay though. What ignited right. like your move to New York? Like, what did you come for college? What was it?
Yeah, when I knew that like theater was my thing, and that like uh-huh. when I kept getting validation from teachers or from people that were seeing shows to tell me like, oh, you could do this, like you should do this, you should pursue it. I just knew that like New York City is where to go, and that's where Broadway is, and so oh, I kind gosh. Of made a promise to myself and all my best friends that like did theater, like we were all going to go to NYU together and we were all going to study musical theater and like we were going right. to move to the big city as soon as we graduated high school. And so I just did it. I didn't apply to any other colleges but NYU. And I said that if I didn't get in, that I would just move to New York to try to just make it happen for myself. So I had a really specific vision of where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do. And I was hell bent on making it happen. And so I did get into NYU, which is lovely.
That's incredible.
But yeah, that was kind of how I made that choice.
It was like you manifested it. I mean, like this was it or it's nothing. I love that though. Good for you. That's incredible. And now here Thank you me. Are. I mean, it's worked out, right? You mean here we are, 6 Broadway shows.
Yeah.
I love that. So most recently you were seen on Broadway as Raoul in the historic run of Phantom of the Opera. What did it mean to you to be in like, I mean, it's the longest running Broadway show in history. Like, what was it like to be in the most historic show on Broadway?
I mean, it was truly wild. My friend Mary Michael Patterson had played Christine for a few years, and I remember seeing the show for the first time with her in the lead and just like crying the whole time. And I remember thinking very specifically as I watched that show, like, well, that'll be a show I never do in my lifetime. I never saw myself in those roles in that world. So when the opportunity presented itself, it was way more for me about what it meant to continue this like relationship with Hal Prince.
Right.
Because I had done Candide at New York City Opera with Hal. And so he became a mentor of mine and kind of folded me into his family. And I would go over to their house and I would have dinners with them and he would give me advice. And, you know, he just became this like grandfather figure to me, which is like,
wow.
To think about it now, it's like, how the hell did Hal Prince become right. like one of your mentors?
Yeah, know? That's incredible.
So when I got Phantom, it was because of Hal. I had reached out to him because I had found myself unemployed and a little nervous about my career and not sure if I could pay rent. And so he kind of gave me some advice. And also at that time, they were looking for a replacement for Ral. So he said, you might be too young, but I'll see what I can do. I'll make a couple of phone calls. And a day later, I was auditioning for Phantom of the Opera. And I had like 3 different callbacks. And he really advocated for me, and then there I was with my next Broadway show.
Gosh.
And I was able to pay rent, and
yes.
Hal Prince co-signed me, you know. So, it was special in that way because I got to continue that relationship for sure.
Oh, that's incredible. What a story. That's so cool. It's interesting you going back to saying that, like, that was a role that you kind of never saw yourself doing in Phantom and everything, because a lot of your roles, like, they've been like dance heavy shows, you know, like, do you kind of like, what do you consider your strongest suit?
I like to consider my strongest suit just storytelling in general.
Uh-huh.
Cause I studied dance so darn hard in high school and I studied voice so darn hard in college. But I've always had this knack for what it meant to actually tell a story. I remember watching older actors when I was a young kid being like seeing who I liked and kind of gleaning from them what it means to be a good actor and how to tell a good story. So I don't know. Because I love all three, singing and dancing and acting, like so,
right.
so much. And it's been my kind of goal throughout my career to never put myself in a box. I never wanted anyone to be able to typecast me or put me in a position where I'm playing the same role over and over and over again.
Right.
So that was another thing that I like manifested, like, I want to do this dance show, but then I want to go over here and do this opera, but then I want to come over here and do this like bit comedy role off Broadway. And then I want to go here and do this television show where I play a rocket scientist. Like you know what I mean? So
yeah, totally.
Every choice I've made along the way, I've wanted it to be completely different from all the choices I've made before. And the industry has like gotten on board with
right.
it in a weird way.
Yeah. I mean, like when you look at your resume, it's like, what, like this is probably like one of the most dynamic resumes like anyone has in the industry. It's so like, it's, yeah, it varies from so many different things. I mean, you literally made it on Broadway, you've made it in television, you made it like all over the place, and opera as well. Like you were doing opera at what was it, you did some opera at Lincoln Center? Not Lincoln Center, there was,
oh, I mean, Sweeney Todd. It was technically
Sweeney,
like a musical,
yes.
theater opera, you know,
right. And
way,
I was looking,
yeah.
like, do you have like an operatic background, or like, is that something you've been interested in?
Well, because I studied dance so hard in high school, I was a dance major at my performing arts high school. And then I would go and I would train at my dance studio every night. So dance was like my world in high school.
Okay.
And it was kind of the way that I kind of got my foot in the door in the industry, because I was a young boy in Texas who could dance. And so that's how I kind of started getting professional roles as a young person in Texas, because there weren't
right.
boys, no one was gonna, you know, there weren't many boys that could twirl in Texas
right.
Without having the fear of getting the shit kicked out of them. But so I made the distinct decision that college, I really wanted to work on my voice, that I really wanted to play leading roles. And so if I had all this dance training in high school, that I really needed to focus on what it meant to good vocal technique. Cause I could, like, I have a musical family, people sing in my family, but I never studied like voice. I never like really study with a voice teacher or like learn the technique of what it was to sing. So that was why I chose to go to a vocal performance program for college as opposed to like a BFA program. So I could really hone in on that.
Yeah, that's awesome. And
so a lot of that.
I mean, that was like one of like the things that I kind of found, because like it's interesting when you do study voice, like at such a young age, you then like build the muscle memories. I mean, it's just like that's what you do. Like you're learning something and you build these muscle memories, and then your voice changes and then you have to relearn it all again. And then it takes like even longer to learn it again, you know? I mean, I'm preaching to the choir, but like it's good that like that's like when you like started to like really hone in and focus on it. It was like a good timing. It was a good choice. That's awesome. And then let's talk about, okay, this is my favorite thing ever. I saw you in On the Town, okay? And obviously you played Chip in On the Town, for those of you who don't know. How long were you with the show? Were you in it from like the beginning processes, like out of town and whatnot?
I was actually doing Hands on a Hard Body on Broadway, and we got the news that like we weren't selling very well and that we're gonna have to close down. So my first audition after finding out that Hard Body was closing was On the Town at Barrington Stage Company. And so it was pretty devastated to like lose my first role on Broadway. I'd been understudying up to that point, and this was a show about Texans. You know, it was this love letter to Texas, and it like took place and 2.5 hours away from where I grew up. So this show was so near and dear to my heart. So for it to be coming to a close, so soon, was pretty devastating to me. So I kind of went into this audition for On the Town at Barrington Stage Company with my head kind of low and like sad that my Broadway show was going to be a thing of the past. So, you know, and it was a summer stock production. You know, it was supposed to be 3 months of employment somewhere in Massachusetts. So it was just, you know, I was an actor. I was about to be out of work. I needed work. I needed money. So I went off and I did that thing. But when I got to Massachusetts, I realized like, oh, John Rando, who won a Tony for Year in Town, is directing this thing. Josh Burgos, who had fame from So You Think You Could Dance, is choreographing this thing. Alicia Umfriss, Elizabeth Stanley, Tony Yazbek, Clyde Alves, like all of these like major heavy hitting players in the theater world were all converging on this like tiny town in Massachusetts.
Right.
And I remember looking at Alicia and being like, this could go to Broadway. And she literally laughed in my face, like laughed at me, because, you know, there's always this, when you do summer stock or when you do like an out of town show, there's always like buzz that it could go to Broadway, and then it's never the reality. So I had this premonition that like, I don't know, this feels right and real and exciting. So I was with it from the beginning, to make a long story short, or to make a long story longer rather. We started it in Massachusetts, and we brought Barrington Stage Company out of the red. They were, you know, kind of in the red financially, and our show literally brought them out, and everyone from New York started coming to Massachusetts to see this show. And then 1.5 years later, after a bunch of workshops and dance labs, we found ourselves on Broadway at the Lyric Theater, and I had my first leading role. It was wild.
Oh, I love that. Oh my God. What? That's so cool. I didn't realize that, like, I mean, I guess like the out of town tryout wasn't really like it meant to be an out of town tryout in a way.
It wasn't. It was a summer stock gig, you know?
Yeah. That's insane to me, because like when you go and see the show and it just like talks about New York, like it's like as if it's like destined to be in New York, you know? It's like a show for New Yorkers, and of course it's supposed to be on Broadway. That's insane. I love that so much. How much did like, I mean, was there a lot of changes from the Massachusetts version to then when it came to Broadway? Like, was your song always in it?
Yeah, my song was always in it. I think the major changes from Massachusetts to Broadway were that we cut a lot of the dance sequences for Massachusetts, because our rehearsal process just wasn't that long to kind of do these extended ballet sequences. So we cut down those a bit. So those were re-implemented for Broadway. And then we actually brought on a script doctor. So we got some permission from, I guess it was the Bernstein Estate, and maybe who have to like actually go in and massage the script a bit and update it a little bit and add some like more jokes that were
relevant.
A bit more, yeah, relevant, yeah. Contemporary. Because a lot of those jokes that were written back in the 40s, you know, they kind of go over all of everyone's heads because they were so niche. So yeah, those were the major changes, is the re-implementation of the ballet sequences and then a little bit of script doctoring. That was it.
Oh my God. Talk to me about Come Up to My Place, because that's literally like one of the most, like you go see the show and that's like definitely one of the songs that like sticks with you. I don't know like what it is. It's like the simplicity of the choreography or the taxi cab, the way it's done. Like, just tell me everything about it. I'm obsessed with that.
Well, that was fully John Rando's genius. He had this vision of this one little bench. And when we did it at Barrington Stage Company, it was literally like the back seat of like a van that like they put on still. Like that was what we like rehearsed on. So it really, the choreography, all of the beats, all of the moments, like they're really John Rando's. It was his idea to have that lever that I like was laying down on that made me look like I was flying off the side of the cab. I mean, it really was,
right. It
was his baby, that moment. So I love physical comedy. I've always done physical comedy. I'm a dancer. So yeah. I loved that I could put my own spin on it, but it really was John Rando that just had this vision, this idea of how it could be executed.
Oh my God. That's insane. Yeah. The way that you guys are able to, like, it was all like comedic timing, honestly. Like guys, you could tell, like you said, like every beat was mastered. Like you had everything, and like kudos to both of you, but also to John Rando. I mean, he's brilliant. I mean,
he's genius.
He did A Christmas Story. He directed me in A Christmas Story.
Oh, right.
Yes. Oh my! And of course, Tony Yazbek was in Finding Neverland with me. And so, like, it's like full circle moment. I appreciate On the Town for all the right reasons. And now, of course, you. Yeah. So. Wait, okay, I want to talk to you about Newsies, okay? Because, like, I look at you, right? And I just see Jack Kelly. I don't know, like, what it is, but, like, you are, like, the perfect Jack Kelly, and you were able to do it at the Muni. Talk to me about, like, that experience and what that, like, role is.
I mean, I've loved the Newsies movie since I was a kid. Mm. And so when I heard it was coming to Broadway, I was like, oh God, I really want this. So I think when they did their very last reading production, like workshop of the show before it went to paper mill, I played Jack Kelly in that reading. I'm pretty sure it was because Jeremy Jordan was off shooting some movie or some television show, so I was probably just a placeholder, but I did that final workshop before paper mill, so I got excited about the prospect of playing it on Broadway back then.
Yes.
And then when it was going to Broadway after paper mill, Jeremy was doing Bonnie and Clyde on Broadway, and so it's like, oh, right. Good, Jeremy's in Bonnie and Clyde. This is my chance, right? So
yes.
Then I believe I could be making this up just for hype, for like storytelling purposes, but I'm pretty sure this is what happened. I think the day of my final callback for Newsies was when they announced that Bonnie and Clyde was no longer going to be running on Broadway. And so I like sank. And I remember walking in for my final callback for Newsies on Broadway and them just like checking out. Like I could tell that the whole room wasn't really looking at me for the possibility of playing, you know, so it's like, oh, there goes that dream. So, so when the Muni launched their season, what was that, 3 or 4 years ago now? I became really good friends with the artistic director at the Muni, and I literally just sent him a text message, and I was like, Mike, if you haven't found your Jack Kelly, I just want to throw my hat in the ring. I will come in for an audition for you. I've wanted to play this role. I got so close to Broadway. Let me know. Peace and love, J. Armstrong Johnson. And he just texted me back and said, it's yours. It was like that.
Oh my God.
It was that easy.
Wow.
So that was a lesson that I learned, like, you know, ask for what you want.
Yes.
But it was super fun because I remember Chris, the director choreographer, I told him on the first day, it was like, I'm a dancer. So utilize me in dance sequences. I know that that's not usually what happened in the Broadway show. Jack like would exit stage right before all the major dance sequences, but I was like, I'm not as good as a Ryan Steele or as a Chris Rice as a Clay Thompson, you know, right. I was like, but I know that I could do some sequences, so please utilize me in that way. And he did. So I was probably the first Jack Kelly to actually be able to do some of the major dance sequences and like lead the Newsies in that regard. But
Oh my God.
I love that dang show so much.
Oh my God. It's so freaking good. It's just like one of the most iconic shows. Oh my God. But it's also not like the most like normal show, you know, like especially with that like role of Jack Kelly and the fact that you were like implemented in all of the dance sequences and everything, like it's got to be vocally, physically, emotionally, like mentally, like it's got to be so demanding on you. Like did you notice yourself like preparing for that show differently than like the other shows that you've been in?
Yeah I remember working out a lot. Like I would actually go to the gym every morning before rehearsals to really get my stamina up. And Santa Fe is probably one of the harder songs that I've ever had to do on stage. The coolest thing about the Muni is it is hot as balls outside. And so like, you like just to get from your dressing room to the stage is your warm up, you know, so you're already sweating, you know, and then you're doing like the big fight scene right before Santa Fe. So like my breath and my blood were flowing and going. Yeah. So yeah. And the adrenaline was up there and I had to like climb a bunch of ladders. I mean, that set was huge. I don't know, because I had done the reading of it like whatever 6 years prior to that, I still had the words in my body. Mm-hmm. I still had the dialect in my body. So it was kind of just revisiting an old friend and doing it in 98 degree weather.
Oh, I love that. Wait. Speaking of revisiting an old friend, you did a Chorus Line on tour and then you did it on Chorus. So, yeah. But you played two different roles, which I think is very, very cool. Talk to me about that experience, because you went from Mark to Robbie, right?
Yeah, Mark to Bobby.
Bobby. Oh my God. What am I doing? Yes.
No, you're good. You're good. But yeah, I got my equity card doing a Chorus Line at like the theater company that I grew up with back home in Texas. So that was the first time that I did it and I played Mark. And so I got my equity card at age 18. And so then when I moved to New York to go to school at NYU, a Chorus Line was happening on Broadway. So I was skipping classes on a regular basis to go to open calls for a Chorus Line. Like it was kind of my intention to drop out of school once I got here. That's why I just wanted to get to New York so I could go on Broadway auditions, right? So for a year and a half, I was auditioning for a Chorus Line Broadway replacements, and I never got cast because my friend Paul McGill, who was playing Mark on Broadway, didn't want to leave his role, which I totally get. So when the first national tour came around, I auditioned for that, and then finally they cast me my junior year of college, and I dropped out of school and never looked back. So
yes.
And that was 10 years prior to the one at City Center. So when Bjorkli and our late, great Bob Avian asked me to do the City Center's production, it had literally been a decade since I'd done a Chorus Line. So for them to come and ask me to play Bobby, which was one of the older people on the line, as opposed to when I played Mark, who's one of the younger people on the line, it was just a really cool way to revisit an old friend and see old friends. I mean, it was Bob and Bjork that put it up on tour, and then they were putting it up at City Center, and I got to see Robin Herder again and Denis Lambert, like there, and Anthony Wayne. Like there were these friends that I met on tour that also converged on the City Center production. So it was dreamy, and it was also really nice to only do it for a week.
Yes, that's right.
That's a hard show.
Oh my God, I can't imagine. But so like another cool thing about that was just like it was an anniversary, like, kind of celebration, right, for Chorus Line? Right. So, like, not only are you, like, performing at City Center, which is, like, historic in itself, it was also, like, celebrating their anniversary. Like, I don't know, like, did you feel, like, an added pressure, like, an added, like, oh, my God, this is, like, amazing? Like, was there anything, like, heightened, I guess, for this compared to the tour?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I was 10 years older. And so there's a bit more of like some like wisdom about what it means to be a performer and how to prepare for a show that I didn't have when I was 20 years old. But I was also doing Phantom of the Opera at the time. They allowed me to take a few weeks off to go do this. I was also producing my Halloween show at the time. So I was essentially doing three different things all at once. And so I didn't really have time to think. I just had to go to the next place, do my job, and then go to the next place. Right. So I didn't think too hard about it. I was just happy to be doing it, to be dancing that show again, to be doing it in such an iconic venue, to be playing a role that I just loved when for so long. You know, I remember being Mark at the end of the line and watching Bobby's monologue and being like, I'm going to do that one day. Then, you know, manifestation, man, manifest.
I love that. Literally, like, this is so funny how many full circle moments that you've had. Like, of just being, like, it's just like right time, right place, right time. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be shy. Your Halloween show that like kind of was just like brushed over. You like created and starred in a show that called I Put a Spell on You, and it benefited Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS, which raised so much money. Talk to me about this. You don't have to be shy. That's not what this is about.
I mean, Hocus Pocus is my favorite movie of all time. I'm not going to pretend like it's not. I am a queer little boy, and Halloween is my favorite time of year. And so I remember as a kid being like, I will be Winifred for Halloween one year, but I can't half-ass it. So when I got my television show, I had like some money in the bank, and like I was like, well, what am I going to do with this money? I want to start producing my own things. And so I had done a solo show at 54 Below that I turned into a live album, and we were going to do an album release concert, and the album release concert was happening in the fall. And so I was like, what if we did a Halloween album release concert? What if I did it as Winifred Sanderson? So I just like started dreaming and like brought my friend DW on to like do some costumes, and brought my friend Katie Beatty on to do wigs. And so we just put together this like CD release Halloween concert and essentially did all the songs from my album dressed as the Sanderson sisters. So that was the seed of it. And then when I realized that we had the costumes and we had the wigs, and I was like, well, we should just keep doing this. We should just make this an annual event. And so that's when I started dreaming, like, I hope we can maybe make this a bigger event at like a larger venue, and like maybe make it a benefit for Broadway Cares. Cause around that time I started doing Broadway Backwards, and I started doing Broadway Bears. And so I was doing a lot of events with Broadway Cares and falling in love with their mission and with their whole business, their whole organization rather. So that was another thing that I manifested, is like, Broadway Cares is going to come on board. And they finally did last year when the pandemic kind of hit us, and we had to take our live cabaret show that we'd started doing at Le Poisson Rouge downtown in the West Village and translate it into like a visual album. But yeah, it's been a wild ride, and we're already starting to figure out what the hell we're going to do this year.
Oh my God. I'm so excited for it because, okay, so many questions here. So I guess I'll start off with like, well, I mean, you talked about just it was going from a live concert and then to a virtual concert. Like, what were some of the obstacles that you kind of had to face with the whole COVID protocols? I mean, obviously you made it virtual, but like, how did it work?
Yeah, I mean, when I saw things starting to go virtual during the pandemic, at first I was like, oh, well, Halloween's not happening this year, whatever, it's fine. And then like, I sat on it for a second, and then I realized that phase four of New York reopening was allowing television and film production again. And so I just kept seeing these things, and it kept pointing me in that direction. And I remember thinking one night, like, oh my God, what are you about to do? Like, but we did it. And I mean, everyone on the producing team had to go to COVID compliance officer training. Like, we got PPE donated. We really like followed protocol on set. Everyone was wearing N95s. And everyone that was asked to do the project, you know, they had been sitting on their butts for 6 months, not doing anything, regardless of whether they were an actor or whether they were a director of photography or whether they were a costume designer or, you know, everyone was like, okay, Broadway cares. Yeah, let's go. And 150 some odd artists came on board to help pull this thing off. And right. everyone showed up with their A game. And what was once just kind of like this like idea that I had was truly coming to fruition in this like beautiful way. And I was just allowing artists to come in and work. I was just like, hey, you want to do this thing? And I'd give them a suggestion and then they would take my suggestion and make something even better like out of it. Yes. I don't know. It was wild the way it all came together. And it was, I don't know, it's some of the hardest work I've ever done. Some of the longest hours I've ever worked, but I'm also sure. some of the most rewarding for sure.
Well, do you know if it's going to be like virtual or live this year? Like, we're
still teetering. We have a location scout happening today, actually, like right after I get off this interview. I'm going to look at a location with Katie Rosen and Danny Marin, my associate God. Producers. So we'll see. Because right now with the Delta variant and mm-hmm. with like indoor theater with, you know, there are mask mandates and it's a Halloween party and a lot of what the show is kind of, the live show really is based around like the specialty cocktail. And so it's really trying to get the audience to drink the specialty cocktail the whole show. And so if there are mask mandates and like maybe you can't drink while watching the show, it's feeling like, oh God, the social party, dark and dirty underground club nature of what the show is when it's live doesn't feel like something we can really pull off with COVID still kind of looming.
Right.
The fall is kind of like flu season and like
yeah.
scientists are expecting like kind of a big wave of COVID to happen in the fall. So I don't want to be working toward a live show and then have it shut down or maybe trying to get an outdoor venue, but having it rained out. Like I'm so at odds with myself yeah. as a producer right now. Like, I don't know what decision to make.
Right.
But we're also kind of behind where we were last year in terms of what it means to do a virtual event. So it's, do we rehash what we did last year? Do we shoot a couple of new music videos and kind of edit them in? Like, so pray for me is what I'm saying. Yes. Because there's so many unknowns right now.
Right. I mean, just you talking about this kind of was like, oh my God, like, I get a little anxiety there. Oh my gosh. I can't believe like, I don't know. Like, I guess you just don't think about it until you're in that situation. It like from an outsider's perspective, it's like, oh, that's easy, you know, like, yeah. but it's easier said than done. It's insane. Yeah,
I've really appreciated what the pandemic gave to me as an artist because I really did I started like thinking like a producer and thinking like a writer. So sure. the time that I had to spend inside doing administrative work or doing like writing work has been exciting and scary. And I want to do more of that. I mean, you know, I studied dance, I studied voice, I studied acting, like I did all, but now I'm studying what's happening behind the scenes. And it's really helping me understand what it's like to be in front of the scenes. And, you know, I'm just trying to understand our world from all angles these days, totally. Which is new and fun.
Yeah, that's, I love that. I see, like, that's exactly, like, my thought process. I see a lot of, like, similarities between us. I'm like, wow, I really like you.
<It's>, the feeling's mutual, Eli.
Thank you. I know, I'm actually going to school basically for that. I'm doing like arts and entertainment management and like nice. One of my classes this semester is how the entertainment industry works and I'm like, great, sign me up. Like,
great.
It's fascinating to me just to like see all of these different things, but anyways, enough. Sorry, I get on tangents.
When you find out about this class, call me, give me pointers.
of course, anything. Well, I want to know, like, I know obviously like the homage to Hocus Pocus and everything like that, but you know, you kind of have like these homages to Broadway as well. Like, you know, the Sanderson sisters is like the Schuyler sister and everything. Like, that was brilliant, you know? Like, right. I mean, what kind of triggered that? Like, what was that kind of thought process?
That was kind of an easy one. We've been doing the Hamilton parody for probably 3 years now. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of like when Hamilton came out, I was like, well, we know we got to do a Sanderson sisters parody, you know? So I wrote the like live version of it a couple of years ago, and like my rapping is not so great. Like my like rhyme schemes weren't so like fresh. So I actually brought my friend Heath Saunders on board to help out with the virtual event, and he killed it. I mean, like his rewrites were so smart and funny, yeah. Wildly good. But yeah, Broadway's where I'm from. It's what I do. It's what I've studied. It's what I love. So and it's a Broadway Cares event, right? So mm-hmm. even when you go to Broadway Bears, there's usually one very musical theater, like comedy-based number, right? So I want to make sure that I'm always having that be a part of what we do. But then also, I want to reach out to the kind of audience that might not know who Broadway is. And so throw a pop tune in there, throw a pop culture reference in there so that like the world outside of Broadway also feels included. Sure. But yeah. So yeah, I don't know.
Oh my God. I love that. That's so fun. It was like, I was watching it and I was like, this is such a brilliant idea. Like in a way it's like so simple yet so complicated that it's just like, it just makes for perfect theater and like entertainment, you know? It was high end.
You can thank Lin-Manuel Miranda for that because he's the one that wrote the tune. So I just had to fill in words and Heath filled in words, you know. They gave us the scansion and the melody.
I was just going to say, like, did you have to like go through a process for that?
Yeah, I actually had a writer's room for the virtual event last year. So it was me and like five or six other humans that would meet every single Friday for about an hour to 2 hours to really talk about, okay, what is this virtual event? What is the through line? Who are our villains? What songs right. are we utilizing for each villain? So we started at the beginning of June and then wrote the show all the way up into September. So right. we were meeting every week. So I had geniuses kind of helping guide me the whole time.
And then did you have to get like the rights for like, say, like to do the Schuyler Sisters like music? But
absolutely. I learned a whole lot about music rights working on the virtual event and sync licenses, because a sync license is different than like a mechanical license. The mechanical license you need for the recording of it, the sync license you need for the recording of a video shoot. So a lot of it was kind of throwing myself in like the deep end. And like at first, Katy Perry wouldn't give us permission to use Roar, and like we had already right. shot the music video, and like I was freaking out that we'd spent all this time and money like featuring Julia Madison as Carol Baskin singing Roar. And so I like found Katy Perry's manager on Instagram. I like DM'd him. I left him messages at his office, and he finally got back to me, and I like pled my case to Katy Perry's manager. He went to Katy. I like sent him the video, and I was like, we already shot this. Like, it would be really, you know, so having conversations with Katy Perry's manager and with Lady Gaga's manager and with Lin-Manuel's assistant, and like really pleading my case for Broadway Cares to use these songs. Doja Cat, I mean, her song was like tied up in a bunch of crazy stuff.
Right.
Like there was exclusivity with the song and this movie that it appeared in. And like, I had to go all the way to the top of like, Warner Brothers to be like,
stop it.
I mean, it's wild the kind of journey that I went on with music rights on the show. Like, I feel like God. I can do anything now.
Yeah, literally. I mean, like, did you kind of like know that going into it, or is it like now that I've learned from that, like this year I have to be like extra careful?
It was truly a learning process. Like, yeah. I was like, you know, I went in being like, well, this is for charity. Like, everyone's going to be on board. It'll be fine. Like, we're raising money for Broadway. Broadway's not happening right now. But, you know, there's so much money tied up in especially pop music.
Yeah.
The popular music in general. So it truly was like, oh, well, I guess maybe I should have thought about this before I shot the music videos, you know. But yeah. I don't know, the way it went, the way that it happened. I mean, we literally got Doja Cat's people, or the people who wrote that Doja Cat song, to sign off on it 24 hours before the live stream. Like,
my God.
And Todrick had already shot the video. Like, Todrick produced his own video in LA. And so he sent us the footage, like fully edited. And then Doja Cat's people were like, no. And I was like, this is, we have 24 hours to make them say yes. Like, it was, yeah. Like, we were in final edits of the show. We had two different edits of the show. One of them that had the Doja Cat song with Todrick and one that didn't. So we were just like waiting to see which one to give Broadway Cares for, like, I mean, it was truly, oh my some God. Of like, I got no sleep that weekend.
I'm sure. Oh my God. That's insane. I can't, this is just like, this is mind blowing to me to like just listen to. It's just like, but it's so fascinating. That's why I love it. It's all very interesting, but it's all very, there's so much that goes into it that you just don't even realize. Anyways, I would be remiss if I didn't talk to someone on the show without talking about their Broadway debut. So your Broadway debut was Hair, right? And so, I mean, like you said, like, you know, you always wanted to be on Broadway, and then here you are, like, you did it. You made it to Broadway in an original cast, like, talk to me about the emotions just with that production and just making your Broadway debut.
I mean, I remember I was out on tour with A Chorus Line when I first got a call from my agent being like, they want to see you for Hair. It's for the understudy for Claude. And I was like, well, I'm in Columbus, Ohio or something. Like, I wish I could come in, but like, I can't. So after I left the tour, I came back to the city and they still hadn't found who they were looking for. So I lucked out that they hadn't found that person. So when I auditioned, here's how it happened. I walked in and I looked a lot like Jonathan Groff, who'd played it at the Delacorte in Central Park. I often got stopped on the street by people.
That is a
like,
huge compliment.
I know. I take it as a compliment for sure. So like back during Spring Awakening times, people would be like, oh my God, I loved you in Spring Awakening. I'd be like, thank you. You know, so people really thought I was Jonathan Groff for a really long time. So me just walking in the room and kind of looking like the guy that had played the role previous to me, I think really helped my case, right? Because a creative team was looking at the boy that they looked at for the whole summer that they did it in the park. So that worked in my favor. And then I sang a song that I've loved since I was in high school. Why from Tick, Tick, Boom. That's the song I sang, to get the role. I remember making, I was like, oh, well, this is a show about a bunch of hippies. So I just remember making really odd choices, like sticking my tongue out on certain words of this scene that I was in. And I made like Jim Rado laugh because of a random wacky choice that I made in the audition. So
yeah,
when I got it, it was like, oh my God. I cried for 10 minutes when I found out that I was cast as a swing and Claude's understudy. And then after the fact, I found out that Gavin Creel was playing Claude. So I was like, wait, hold on. Wait, you mean like my idol? You mean like the guy that I've always aspired to be is the one I'm understudying? So that was kind of mind blowing. And then to actually meet Gavin Creel and to fall deeply in love with him and to like have him show me what it was to be a leading man on stage and off stage. It was truly an education in what it meant to lead a company. Not just artistically, but spiritually and energetically. And it was around the same time that we were fighting for marriage equality. And so we weren't just like living the life of like the protester hippies on stage. We were also going to rallies in Times Square and we were marching in Washington for marriage equality and singing Let the Sunshine In behind Lady Gaga in front of 30,000 people, you know. So it was really a movement. It felt like we were making change in the world in like 2009 in the same way that like that generation was making change in the world in 1969, you know? So I don't know. That's when like social change and art became like really important to me to always have that at the forefront of everything that I did. And that was a lot to do with Gavin.
Wow, that's incredible. Oh my God, chills, literally. No, it's true. Just like the impact that art can have on literally anyone and anything is just... The pandemic has taught me that, you know? I mean, everything, it's just all so related. Yet, we're not essential workers and we're not funded properly at all. So that's interesting. It's very...
I think very we should fun. Be considered essential, to be completely honest. You know,
I do too. I mean,
performance artists, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you saw everyone in the pandemic just like, I mean, what did everyone do? They turned to music to calm them down. They turned to movies and TV shows to pass the time. I mean, like,
right.
they went to us, like, you know, like, in so many right. ways. And, like, I mean, just, I don't know. It's mind-blowing, but politics. Okay. Politics. Right. Before I let you go, we have to talk about your 54 Below show, because I am so excited for it. You're paying homage to your hometown in Texas. It's your birthday. How excited are you? Is this like your first time like performing live since the pandemic?
No, I've done a couple of smaller like solo cabaret kind of gigs. Like I did an outdoor thing upstate in Saratoga last summer. Oh. I did a small little gig at like the Friars Club the other night with a piano, but this is my first time to like have a full band and to create a new show and to like really have fun with like my favorite lady singers again. So that's what's exciting. And I've never done a country show. You know,
yeah.
my first show I did at 54 Below was like so eclectic. It was like about all of the music that I love. And I did country and I did R&B and I did musical theater and I did classical. And like, I kind of ran the gambit of musical forms. So now I'm kind of, you know, kind of like how Gaga did like her, what was it? Not Jolene. Was it Jolene? Was that? That album.
The wrong person to ask.
It's going well.
Sorry.
Great reference, Jay. But I don't know. Now I want to kind of like start focusing in on all of these genres that have meant so much to me. So I can do like a deep dive and a deep study into what it means to like do a country show. So I'm just excited. I mean, I thought if I wanted anything for my birthday, what would it be? And it would be to get on stage again and sing with my favorite people and have a live band behind me and share that experience with an audience. So when 54 Below reached out to me and said, these are some dates we have open, would you like to do a show? I saw my birthday on there and I was like, yeah, I want to do a show on my birthday. So that's kind of how that all came together.
Oh my God, that's so cool. I didn't know if you did that on purpose or if that was kind of like all 54 Below was kind of offering.
Yeah, it was kind of serendipitous in that way, you know. I mean, I think they gave me like a list of like 20 some odd dates and I literally saw my birthday. So
oh
I was like,
God.
You know, this country show that I've had in my head for so long, that's what I should do. Let's go back to my roots. Let's go back home to 54 Below and let's invite all my two favorite lady singers, Amanda yes. Williams-Ware and Allison Robinson, who are also my Sanderson sisters every year in the Halloween yes. show. So yeah, I'm really, really excited about it. And those that can't actually make it to Feinstein's 54 Below on September 1st can actually tune into the live stream, because it will be live streamed, which is very, very cool. I was so excited that 54 Below added me to that part of what they're doing. So, you know, if you're tuning into this and you live somewhere outside of the tri-state area, like tune into the live stream. I think it's only going to be like $15 to tune in on the night of. So
yeah, totally. If you cannot make it, check out the live stream. But honestly, like, it's so different in person, you know. Like, I've been watching some of the 54 Below live streams, and then I went to Antonio Cipriano's show at 54 Below, and I was just like, oh my God, it's so much better live. You know, like,
of course.
It is also just like the feeling of just like being in a room with live music again. It is just like something that we haven't experienced. So it's like life changing. Right. So if you can go to 54 Below on September 1st, I highly recommend. And maybe you can meet Jay and like so many other people and all of these wonderful, so many people will be there. I mean, you're incredible. You're a star. September 1st, at what time?
9:30, I think, is showtime. So it's a kind of a late show. It's a Wednesday night, but come on out. It's going to be a rocking good time.
Yeah. So check it out at 54 Below, or you can watch it at the comfort of your bed or couch or chair, whatever you choose to watch it on the live stream. But Jay, thank you so much for joining me and just talking to me about everything that you have going on. It's so exciting. I never asked, do you have like a date for Hocus Pocus as well?
Yeah, we're still working on that.
Okay.
So we don't have a date set quite yet. If we do the live show, it'll be a certain date. If we do another virtual event, it'll be a certain date. So stay tuned, because that'll all be coming to fruition in the next couple weeks.
Amazing. Well, I'll make sure to keep everyone updated and keep plugging it. But this is so exciting. Everyone go check out 54 Below. Stay tuned for Hocus Pocus. Oh my God, I put a spell on you. It's just so similar. And all of the amazing things. And drop your Instagram handle so everyone can follow you along.
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram at J_A_Johnson, just to make your life really difficult trying to find my Instagram handle.
Amazing. I love it. Well, thank you so much again. It was so great to talk to you again. I know we talked briefly this earlier this week. It was great to see you. And it's thank good you to see for you doing too. This. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. You're very good at this. You should keep doing this. This was a really fun interview.
Thank you. Oh my God, I'm so glad you had fun. Take a bow, J. Armstrong Johnson. I cannot thank him enough for coming on this week's episode. I was so happy when we were able to figure this out, because this has kind of been in the works for a little bit. And then his 54 Below show was coming out, and I've wanted him on forever. And his 54 Below concert was coming out, which is going to be on his birthday. So if you don't go celebrate with him, I just feel sorry for you, because you should. And it's going to be amazing. And he's uber talented, and you're going to have an amazing night. And I will be there and celebrating his birthday with him. And it's going to be live streamed. So even if you can't be there, like, it's okay, because you can still be with there. And that's probably how I'm going to actually be able to do it, actually, on the live stream. So I hope to see you all on the live stream. And of course, please, please, please watch out for I Put a Spell on You, because if you're a real fan of the Broadway community, no offense to anyone who has not heard of it, but if you're a real fan of the Broadway community, you probably have heard of this, because it's been such a huge deal over the past, like, 2-3 years. It's gotten just so big. And I Put a Spell on You is going to be unforgettable yet again this year, and I will continue to keep you all updated if that's going to be on a virtual scale, if that's going to be on a live theater, or if it's going to be both, you know, like his 54 Below show, where it's going to be like both in person and live stream for people who can't make it. But it's all to benefit Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS, which is all that really matters, because he's spending his own money, he's taking his own time away, just like all you guys heard him, like everything that he has to do with the rights to songs and the locations and costumes and all of these things that he has to do to produce and star and write it. And like, it's just mind boggling. And this is all like, he's not benefiting from any of this as far as like getting paid or doing whatever. This is all going to a wonderful organization that has helped so many in the Broadway community. So if you can, please check out I Put a Spell on You, and please, by doing that, you will be supporting Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS, and hopefully you can donate if you are able to. And it's a wonderful thing. And all the things he had to say about On the Town, and just kind of how he created it, and seeing talking about Newsies, how it was kind of just always a dream of his to do that role. Mm-hmm. And then of course the first reading, and how it was kind of like he felt like a filler for Jeremy Jordan. Just that conversation, there was so many conversations that I just loved it. I just loved the flow of it. I just loved what he brought today, and what he was so willing to share with everyone. He was just so raw and so real. And I think it made for a great episode. And I've been in that spot before, and I'm glad that, you know, I'm not the only one. It still stinks, obviously, and we still think about it. But you know, it wasn't meant to be, and there's something bigger and better out there. And then he was able to do On the Town, and then he was able to do it again. You know, he was able to do it at the Muni, and he was able to kind of make history in it at the same time, because it wasn't that traditional Jack Kelly role that Jeremy Jordan was able to play, because J. Armstrong Johnson just has a range of
talents that are also strengths of his, and he was able to do a few extra things and kind of highlight the character more. And I just think it was all very interesting just to hear all about it. So with that being said, thank you, Jay, for coming on and sharing so much. You brought so much insight and you brought so much rawness that we were able to truly have a conversation that was open. And I think it opened a lot of people's eyes to just how the industry works, but also like what happens and kind of how we deal with things as actors. It's kind of been a theme the past two episodes, you know, with calling out and then this with dealing like, oh, this is kind of like my role. Like Trevor, the Greatest Showman, like those things happen, you know, like those were kind of like our roles that we had helped create. And then all of a sudden we're not going to be able to do them for other reasons, you know, like that some that we can't control and some that like, it's like, well, how do we, well, actually all of them that we can't control, because at the end of the day, it's not our decision. And of course they obviously still loved them because they brought him back to do it at the Muni. So like, there's just so many, this industry is so bizarre and there's so much to talk about this industry. But it's like at what lengths, you know, it's a very difficult industry. It's a very odd industry. So slowly, kind of hinting things in there and kind of working things out. I think it, really opens a light on a lot of things that go on in the industry that people may not realize or understand. And that's why like, oh, what's next is such a touchy topic, you know, for actors. And oh, like, I hope you get this role or whatever, and kind of getting your hopes up. And it's like, you can't, please don't. Cause then I'm going to do it and it's not going to work out for some reason that none of us can control, you know, like there's just so many things about it in there. Yeah. So it's just such a bizarre industry. And I'm glad that we have been able to bring things up about it, in the past couple episodes. And I think I'm going to just continue to ride that wave and see if I can, add things here and there in future episodes, because I do think that it's something that needs to be talked about more. And it's not something that is always talked about and kind of something that is dealt with, that the actors kind of deal with alone. And that's no way to be, because we all experience it. So, that being said, that's a wrap on this week's episode. I know it was a little bit of a long one. There was a lot to talk about. Of course, Jay was a wonderful guest. And we have another wonderful guest. Actually, next week's episode is going to be a really, really fun one, because it's going to be a kind of medley episode like we did with the Pride medley. And I'm doing it again because that episode did so well that I think I want to do it again. And that is going to be of the red carpet. So there's going to be so many guests. It's not going to be just four guests kind of talking about their sexuality and whatnot. It's going to be so much more than that. And it's going to be a bunch of guests talking about the return of Broadway and kind of if they're going to be in an upcoming show, they're talking about that. And there's just so much to go into it. So I'm really excited to share it all with you. I'm going to be like a narrator. It's going to be a very interesting podcast next week. And I'm very excited for it. And I know it's going to be another great one. And I hope to see you there for it. So stay tuned. And I hope to see you next week. Thank you so much for listening. Bye, everyone.
For this episode's Curtain Call, I would like to recognize a few people who also deserve to take a bow. This podcast would not be possible without the help from Dori Berenstain, Brittany Bigelow, Katie Rosen, Alan Seals, and the team at the Broadway Podcast Network. Next in line to take a bow is Tessie Tokash, who edits the audio and all the visuals for this podcast. A special thanks to patrons Brian Thompson, Pat McNamara, the listeners at PCC, as well as all of the other patrons for their continued support. If you're interested in becoming a patron, go to patreon.com/TAB. And if you enjoyed this week's episode, don't forget to subscribe on the platform that you're currently listening to this on. Also, feel free to give us a follow on Instagram at Take a Bow Podcast. Take a Bow's logo is designed by Giselle Bustos, and the music is by Nikki Torsha and Cormac Collinon. Bye, everyone. Hope to see you next week.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.